This is part two of an interview recorded in Dublin with Ashanti Odson, who was a former member of the Black Panther Party and an active US anarchist. Ashanti is in Dublin for the Anarchist Book Fair, and you can hear him speaking in person on Saturday, March the 7th, at the Anarchist Book Fair in Liberty Hall.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with Ashanti Odson and Paul Bowman. One of the things that struck me travelling around the US, coming from Ireland, was the very visible amount of policing. I probably saw more people being arrested in my time there than I'd seen in all my previous time in Ireland. And I don't mean political arrests, I just mean like cops with shotguns arresting people at the side of the road. It was part of the background. I think it was Philly I was in. I actually thought at one point there must be a police convention on them, there's so many cops in the street. But one of the other things that's really striking is the number of people that are still in prison for stuff that happens, you know, from the movements of the 60s, the 70s and the early 80s. I mean, in the Irish context, those people are often in government, you know, both north and south. But, you know, you seem to have a state that's determined to continue to punish people, in many cases, long after they've, you know, those movements they were part of had dissipated. I mean, I know that's one of the areas you've done a lot of work in.
Right. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Jericho, the National Jericho Movement, which is the main political prisoner organization in the United States. We represent most of the kind of official list of political prisoners, which we think is around 100 people. Though I think I say this as an anarchist, I think there are more. It just depends on the definition. But, you know, the thing, the connection between the two is that from the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the counterintelligence program, and all their updated programs, which might be Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, and everything else, is the use of the police to just keep people under control. But a big difference between then and now is that the police departments across the board, but especially in the major cities, have gotten just about every resource that they have wanted, from technological to material resources. So, like, for example, I live in Harlem. I've been in Harlem for the last year, but before that, I was like 20 years or more in Brooklyn. But in these communities in New York, in these black and brown poor communities, there's nothing but police, you know. And you look at them and they look dangerous, you know. They're not your Officer Joe from back in the 50s and 60s. Their trainings is even different. A lot of them was from the military, or, you know, even a lot who were in Vietnam, you know, when they came back, or different other wars, they joined the police force. And their trainings doesn't look at us as human beings. They look at us as if they were in Vietnam, then we're the enemy. If they're in Iran or Iraq, you know, we're the enemy. You know, so when they treat us, they don't, you know, they don't even talk to us with any amount of respect. It's typical to see them just get a group of black Latino youth, for example, high school students, and just throw them up against the wall and pat them down, you know, and not even show ID, you know, because they're technically supposed to show you some kind of badge, but it just gets to be so regular that this is what they do. So these intimidation terrorist practices are very widespread. Serves the same purpose, though. It's like, whether they are around or not, people feel their presence. You know, they are intimidated. They are not likely to do anything that violates the law, you know. And I think it serves this system's purpose of keeping people with a subtle level of terror in their lives, you know. So a lot of them, I mean, like, they don't know what we tried to do in the 60s and 70s with the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, and a lot of times Black Liberation Army directly responding to police violence in our communities. You know, a lot of folks don't know that it was virtually war, you know. But if they knew, then they would know that there's this treatment of these occupation armies, which a lot of us still call them, is unacceptable. They do not have to accept it. from knowing their rights to just not accepting that kind of abuse from people with guns who represent the state. You know, so you get examples of groups that do cop watch, like the Malcolm X grassroots movement in New York and in other cities. I'm a general member of the one in New York. Does cop watch. You know, it trains people in how to use the cameras. It trains people in know your rights, and it wants people to know that the behavior is unacceptable. You know, the camera also allows people to see how the police force, it really backs them up from doing some of their obvious, you know, Gestapo treatment, because they don't want to be filmed. They don't want this film to appear in court. So when they do see that film, if they don't actually just directly try to get it from you, then they're going to kind of modify their behavior. They don't like it. You can even listen to some of the dialogues a lot of times where they're talking real bad to the camera people, but the camera people keeps the camera on them. They know their rights in terms of the legal distance. They know what they can do. They know what they can observe. It helps, but it needs to be more widespread. You know, like, so like for me though, it just tells me that we are still at war. The problem though is that between the 60s and now, that at war perspective, or that knowing that this force is out here to just totally control you forever, if you don't have it, then you just think that it's a police force that kind of is like, they're not acting right and some kind of reform needs to happen. Whereas those of us from the old school movement and people like me now who are anarchists, it's about getting rid of the police force, along with getting rid of the state, along with getting rid of prisons, along with getting rid of the judicial systems and all the philosophies that go into what is crime, what is justice, and what is punishment, you know. So I think that that's like what's kind of key now is people got to kind of broaden their understanding of the role of the police force and all the connections of it to the prison industrial complex, to the criminal injustice system, and even into the universities that actually teach philosophies of justice, which are just as racist and colonial as they were from the beginning, you know, in terms of keeping people oppressed.
I remember a couple of anecdotal stories, but I think it was in Baltimore I was talking to someone, and they were sort of saying that people probably aren't aware of this, but a lot of schools actually have cops in them, you know, they're metal detectors and all that. And the funny thing they said was some of the more progressive schools that were a bit clued in, they'd try and hire a cop who was a bit of a psychologist, you know, so he could talk to the kids and try and set them right, because there was no school budget, basically, for people who could sit down and talk to kids with problems. There was just a school budget for a cop in the school. In a general sense, that struck me as one of the marked differences, that in the European context, I mean, we have, obviously, the police here, and they can be very violent, so you have all that sort of context as well, but you also have a state that actually puts a fair amount of effort into looking for ways to kind of buy people off, to kind of ameliorate stuff. You know, like there's a carrot and a stick being used.
Right.
A lot of the time in the US, it's kind of like there's a stick. You know, you kind of go, yeah, there's no carrot around here anyway, you know. You know, I guess it's because of the fact there's no real social welfare system, you know. So this whole set of economic choices have been made by the people in charge, which are basically like, yeah, we're just going to, you know, look at ways to divide people and keep them down. In terms of being an activist within that, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is one thing it feeds into is people getting really paranoid. And actually, often, I'm not sure paranoid is the right word, because, you know, like the whole Green Scare trials show there's often justification. I mean, if you look at the transcripts for some of these, you're looking at stuff that where probably nothing would have happened except somebody who's working for the FBI comes along, winds people up, buys the plane tickets, buys the stuff for them, gets them to do something, and then arrests them. You know, and you're sort of going, well, without that person there, this would probably been four people sitting in a pub having a drunken conversation. You know, so you can see where it comes from. How do you think people can deal with that sort of thing?
Well, it's you know, in New York, the United States, there are those cases from like Green Scare victims that happen pretty much the scenario that you just laid out. You know, where you come to find that there's this one person in there who's pretty much an agent and has encouraged classic stuff that they did in the 60s, which in a certain extent, and a certain extent, like, you would hope that the younger generation would know, but sometimes you still see the same thing happen. And next thing you know, that there's an arrest, that they were, that they either firebombed something or they were going to, and then the agent comes out at the trial and, you know, all this other stuff. But it does create a heavy level of paranoia. It is so reminiscent of what happened with us in the 60s, too. You know, whereas even right now, I think the animal liberation and Earth First movements have suffered a lot. I think they've lost a lot of support that they're trying to hold on to and regain, because people are scared, because they don't know who now is an agent, what trial, who's going to pop up in the next trial that's going to be testifying for the prosecution. But it falls into also with, like, the atmosphere that they create in our communities, from what the police does to the television programs that people watch. These cop shows, there's nothing but cop shows, and they're the most popular shows, right? And a lot of times they focus on, like, the new forensic sciences. And it all feeds into, like, the state, the system, the police always get their man or woman, you know, or activists, because there's been certain scenes where they actually been, they done got the anarchists that were getting ready to do something, right? But it gives this impression that you cannot do anything without the system knowing and eventually getting you before you even do it, or right after. You can just expect that they're going to come get you. And it shuts people down, you know. And the thing is to try to get your supporters and those communities that are in sympathy with you, don't back up at this point. Actually step forward, you know. Don't let people think that this is such a blow to the movement that it is going to, like, break the back of this movement. You know, but I think that's the same reason why, like, the people of Harlem, you know, they're not really fighting back this gentrification and militarization of the police in these communities. They're not trying to stop it because they've been just convinced it's not worth fighting back. But then our job is to kind of help them as much as we can, say, yeah, it is worth fighting back, and we must, with a sense of urgency, as if it's a state of emergency, we must. You know, but that's basically what's been happening. And so it's like you get a new crop of political prisoners coming from these younger movements, who I really admire them, because the animal and Earth First folks have been so creative, and their actions in the United States have been very broad and very numerous, actually. And I guess it was a concern of the FBI, because they called him the domestic terrorist number one, you know. But because they've been so active, and I guess maybe a little embarrassment to the FBI and other folks, that a lot of attention and resources was put into shutting them down. Now, even their use of the internet to, like, put information out on who are corporate board people or who are stockholders, and present other strategies on how one may frustrate efforts of corporations into killing animals or experimenting on animals, or putting poison in different foods and stuff, that, and in some sense, that you're going to make the foods healthier, you know. But it extends also into, like, the Black Liberation Movement, the Native American movements, the Puerto Rican movements. The paranoia has returned, because they will take a person from here, this movement there, arrest them or kill them, like Filiberto, the Puerto Rican independence movement, a couple of years ago, was shot and killed in Puerto Rico. And then they have continued in Puerto Rico, the FBI, with arresting people. So this paranoia over the Puerto Rican communities and the movements has arisen. The San Francisco 8 case, in terms of the Black liberation movement in Black communities, you know, has risen, because no one knows who's next. To keep that paranoia going, it's like you see what they're doing. But at the same time, those of us who do political prisoner work, we're still trying to figure out every day how to just get the ones out who've been in there 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And it's frustrating, you know. And I can say honestly, it's frustrating. We ain't quite figured out how to deal with it and how to have some successes. But I think it's so important that we figure it out soon, because people need to see successes from movements of resistance.
In relation to the conversation we were having earlier, like in terms of trying to build alliances and contacts geographically, but also between different groups of people, I think one of the problems with the creation of the paranoid, and probably part of the reason it's done, is it makes that task very difficult. I mean, I know even in relation to relatively minor stuff here, you know, it wasn't that unusual if you are having a meeting and somebody walks in who's not known and is maybe a little bit older or a little bit smarter dressed or doesn't quite fit in, and you have people coming over and going, he's a cop, mm-hmm. you know, like that, and that's where you don't have the same sort of thing at all. I mean, these conditions must make it very difficult for movements that don't know each other at all to actually build links, you know, mm-hmm. because people are going to be suspicious of outsiders.
Right. There was one case several years ago where it was a protest in Philadelphia, I think, and there was a black guy who, just a curious black guy who actually happened to join the protest, but he didn't quite look like the young activist. And the young activists actually got to whispering amongst each other about, I think he's an Asian, you know. And he was just basically a working class guy, you know. But he didn't wear his hair certain ways. He didn't dress certain ways, just basic working class. And it actually got around to him, you know, and he left. Mm. But it's that kind of thing also that comes from this that atmosphere that they created, this paranoia that people get to talking. You know, that was done in a very irresponsible way. But hey, it's young people, and they just didn't know. But hopefully they learned from it, because they probably just lost somebody who could have been, you know, a supporter or an active member, you know.
And could have been a link to people outside of their network, to a link to mm-hmm. more people in ordinary working class communities who wouldn't feel that connected to
right.
young people as well.
So we miss opportunities like that, right? Well, if so, then I would go back to the police and the schools. Because you said that's not here in Ireland?
No. God, no. Jesus. God, no.
They are so in the schools, the high schools and junior high schools. You got metal detectors. You got the police is all in the schools. And it's the same thing. You're talking about an institution that is supposed to be of learning, that has every sign of imprisonment, jail, confinement, you know, and terror. Because every student knows that at any moment, any of them police could have them arrested or arrest them on the spot. Now, how you learn in an environment like that? Now, some people will say, well, that's because the students are bringing in guns and everything. But then there's a bigger picture to that. They may well be bringing in the guns, but what? Why are they bringing in guns? What's the bigger picture going on in their lives and their communities? And whose idea was it to bring in the police? But also, when you look at other institutions in our communities, they are like jails, you know. So it's not just the schools, but you go into the hospitals, you go to the public assistance centers, you go into the library, you know, there's checkpoints. You can't just go in. You got to show ID. You got to go past the security. You know, so here's the United States, this land of freedom and democracy and all the other bullshit. But it's like so much is like under surveillance control. So like even, you know, like I'm still kind of on the periphery of critical resistance. And critical resistance, which fights the spread of the prison industrial complex. But when you deal with that, you're talking about the prison industrial complex that is not just that they're building new prisons, but how that whole culture extends right into your communities, because your neighborhoods actually become extensions of this same prison industrial complex control. The whole culture is geared towards it, which is why I think that there's so many cop programs, you know. And even the ways that, you know, maybe it's not intentional, but the ways that a lot of times we raise our kids in such an authoritarian manner just feeds into this also. It's like you're under control and you're not to question it, you know. But these students in these schools, it's like they rebel, but there's no real direction towards it, because they don't, even the information that they get is nothing that inspires them to want to be different. You know, when I go in there, and if I go into the high schools and talk about the Panthers, generally it's the first time they're going to hear about the Panthers. They're going to be angry because no one ever told them. But it's just the whole idea. They never get a history that will inspire them. They never get economics. They'll never get mathematics that will help them to understand their society and their role in it. You know, so the schools is like, it's for me, it's not that the schools are failing the students. The schools are intentionally dumbing them down, keeping them terrorized, because that's what schools are supposed to do in a capitalist society. You know, so I'm not all that in support of people who want to try to find ways to reform the schools, you know, because I go to the what the role the schools play. It's the same as the police. It serves to fortify the system, you know. It serves to give them enough information that they're either going to be cause or they're not going to be a problem, you know, but not to inspire real learning, not to inspire real education. That's not what they're supposed to do. So why do we put up with it? I would like to see more activism from the communities, where the community is either taking over them schools to institute real programs that are geared towards the liberation and self-organization of these schools for the communities, or shut them down and do independent education in your community like folks used to do in the 60s. You know, but anything else is just a really terrible compromise, because these students come out of there and it's almost like an automatic pipeline to the prisons, you know. For me, that's the state of emergency. You know, it's the kind of urgency that we really need to step in here and do something.
And I remember reading back in the 1980s or the 1990s some statistics about the percentage of young African Americans who end up having some kind of encounter with prison before their mid-20s or so. I mean, can you talk about what the statistics really are these days?
I mean, I'm not sure if I'm going to know the statistics.
Right. But I mean, I remember hearing in the 90s talks of something like one-third of young African-American males under 30 would encounter the prison system or the justice system at some stage.
I just read where Cornel West said that one of every three black males born will experience prison in their life. Mm. And he put that in, like, this is a state of emergency, you know. But it is high. I mean, the thing is, it is so high that you got to think of, well, why don't people focus on it? And even part of, you know, fighting the prison industrial complex, you get all these figures. And I get tired of the figures personally. But some of them are things like New York State might cost them $60,000 a year to imprison someone, you know. And you're like, well, damn, $60,000, why don't you just give the money to them? They really just need to resource.
Give them half the money, they'll be right. You know? Save money on the deal.
But if they're not going to do that, then there has to be a reason.
Sure.
You know, you may not like it. It may sound like it's just crazy out of this world, but it is really just that clear. Mm-hmm. They don't want these children to be able to be productive and free members of society. You know, so why not set up a situation where they go to prisons or they kill each other off in the streets? You know, because everybody know in New York that, you know, police corruption, criminal justice corruption, everything plays a part in what sweeps people up into the prison system. You know, so stop fooling ourselves. It's easy to live in some kind of, what's the pill? The Matrix pill.
The red pill, blue pill.
You know, it's easy to live in the one where you're not going to deal with the reality. Mm-hmm. When you know the world is fucked up. You know, but it is high, and like to this day, if they're not going off to prison, especially black males, but increasingly black and women of color also, is that they're under surveillance in some other way. So again, the prison industrial complex is much larger than just physically confining. They may have ankle bracelets on. They're home, but they got ankle bracelets. Or they got a report every week or every month to their parole officer, probation officer. Or they're in some kind of GED, general education diploma program, that if they don't report at regularly, then they're subject to go to prison, you know, all kind of stuff, you know. So when you look at it like that, they got so many, especially black males, but increasingly black women, under control, that it is just extraordinary, you know. And what that means also is that the families, you know, are always kept maybe in such a state of insecurity, because they don't know whether they're going to have this person around as just a loved one, or as another working person that can bring in some more income or whatever, or to provide some kind of role models for the young folks coming up. You never know. And for me, I just think that it's all very intentional. This is what you do with those groups or those classes in your society that you deem a threat. You know, you control them. That's what capitalism does. But do you ever hear the word capitalism in the United States? No. Do you ever hear really people talk about class? You know? No. You know, because the United States is real good at just camouflaging all that, because it helps to lend this feeling that we're all just the same. We're all Americans, same opportunities, you know. So it's very hard to, like, break through, you know, that mindset.
Well, on that question, of course, the whole thing about we're all Americans in this together, it's an equal society, anyone can make it, I guess that brings us naturally onto the topic of your new president.
I see.
And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what do you think. I mean, we're all anarchists here. I think we have low expectations of what the change of government is going to really produce, but to tell us a little bit about what you think the impact psychologically, politically, in terms of people's expectations are on African Americans and so on, how it's...
Well, the first thing, I know you said it jokingly, but he ain't my president. I ain't vote for him. I'm an anarchist, you know. But found out a lot of anarchists also voted for Obama. You know, I'm still from that school that says if voting could change anything, it would be illegal, you know. But some real interesting things happened in the United States during the primaries. Because when it was obvious that Obama was going to be this person, before they had the Democratic Convention, there's all this build up, especially with the anarchists, to shut it down. They're going to shut down the Republican Convention. They're going to shut down the Democratic one. But the shutting down the Democratic one posed some different issues, because people needed to be aware of that no matter how we see Obama, symbolically to especially the black community, but broader to a whole bunch of other people too, but especially the black community, people wanted this black man to win. So what would it look like in the United States with here's the anarchist or the shut them down movement led by the anarchists that is heaping all of this criticism and activism against Obama, you know? And I know that some folks like Cindy Milstein and others wanted to, like, really get that discussion going before they got too far, you know, because regardless of what you feel, like, this guy was going to be an inspiration to the black community. I mean, it's clear why, you know, we've been beat down so long, you know, we've been denied so much that we're grasping for anything. So the average person is like, to see Obama be able to even get this far is inspirational. They may not look at all the other factors, like, not only what is his policy, but who's creating the way for him to do this? Don't nobody just like they want you to believe Abraham Lincoln did it, you know, just, oh, I want to be president, you know, and it happens. There's powerful people, corporate, military, others, political others, who have decided that he will be a good face for the empire. That's it. This ain't like he just wants to do this and all of a sudden everybody's okay with it. But you can't say that to folks in our community, from the black community, because they're feeling like you're trying to rain on their parade. Yet, I think we got a responsibility, and Cornel West talks about this too. Even though he's liberal and so in other ways, I think in a lot of ways he's very sharp, but I think his solutions are very liberal. But I think he's right when he says there are those of us who know that we got to be truth tellers, regardless how it comes to people. So I think, just like Malcolm, you got to tell your truth. So we still need to be able to say in public venues, Obama is not going to solve our problems. You must look at not only who he is, but what his proposals are. He's about the American way, which means that this is the same way that keeps us on the bottom, that we must stay focused on what our goals are. And some of us did, you know, especially like in the black movement. Some of us was like using forums to like say, hey, this Obama mania, you know, we need to talk about it. Because a lot of folks from the left, the black left, the left in general, and even there was even folks who was anarchists and Marxist-Leninists and others were coming to these conclusions. One Marxist-Leninist person in particular from the black cultural movement said that he made a dialectical analysis and this found that this was the correct thing to do. Typical, you know, the Marxist-Leninist thing, you know. But it showed how many people was like buying into this. So now we have to figure out, it's going to happen, he's going to win. How can we position ourselves to tell our truth and also be able to tell people that there are other ways that we can fight? That whenever this honeymoon is over, we need to be in a position to continue fighting. That we cannot rest. That this is not it. We have not won, you know. So it's a difficult position. I mean, we've never faced a position like this. Who thought this would ever happen? So, I mean, it poses some things now that we got to really figure this stuff out. From the anarchists to the nationalists to the Native American folks who are fighting for sovereignty to the Puerto Rican independentistas, all of us have got to, like, really figure this out. So you hear a lot of discussions now, it's like even around political prisoners, we're trying to figure out how to work within this different situation, you know. We don't think Obama's going to free anybody, but should we propose a way to get to the Attorney General to say, hey, these people have been in here for such and such number of years as a result of FBI illegalities with the counterintelligence program, da-da-da-da-da-da, maybe, you know, for whatever it's worth. But most of us who've been in the movement for years and were very clear, know that we must continue to organize. We must continue to promote self-organization amongst people around the issues that directly affect their lives. But people like me and others in the anarchist movement, we're like, the empire's got to come down. We have got to be so clear about that that there can never be any part of it, aspect of it, that will resolve our problems, that will bring us the kind of lives and the kind of freedom that we deserve.
I think with the Obama thing, when I was traveling around, it was, and I interviewed people, it's the last question I always end it, because it was during the primaries. And I think when I was doing the Northeast, he was kind of, you know, he was starting to take off, but it wasn't at all clear that, you know, where it was going to go. But by the time I got to the Midwest, it was suddenly clear it was going to be a showdown between him and Hillary. And it was interesting because people were talking about it in a different way. Like, I remember I was in Pittsburgh, and the person I was talking to there was saying that one of the things she'd noticed was that loads of people in communities where previously had very low interest in politics or no interest at all, she was suddenly seeing, you know, posters for him going up. Mm-hmm. And the specific thing I remember was I was getting a Greyhound from Cleveland to Detroit, mm-hmm. and Greyhound scheduling had gone wrong, so we were late leaving, everybody was really angry and animated. And I think that for that reason, it ended up with the entire back half of the bus being engaged in this protracted conversation for the whole mm-hmm. distance. They all wound up. About half the conversation was about Obama and what all this meant, and mm-hmm. was the country changing. And, you know, being a Greyhound is kind of an interesting audience, because, see, it's largely people of colour, but it's also kind of poor mm-hmm. whites, and, you know, people who have to travel by Greyhound. Mm-hmm. So just what was being fired backwards and forwards. And the fact that you had a very... you don't have that many public political conversations between strangers in the US. Right. But this was, you know, this context, the whole back half of the bus, you know, talking about racism, all this sort of stuff being fired around. There's an interesting effect, I think, possibly there in terms of, you know, people who previously had not taken any particular interest in this were suddenly following all this and going, oh, you know, this can make a difference. And what happens when these expectations aren't met? Because obviously they're not going to be met.
Mm-hmm.
And in the context of the, you know, the crisis anyway, where lots of people are being thrown out of work, I mean, do you think there's any potential around it having mobilized basically a new layer of people that maybe now will be looking for something different? And should that be part of what we're addressing? Or is it the case that that mobilization is so limited that really there's nothing you can do around it, you know?
Yeah, no, I believe that, yeah, that is going to bring a lot of people into different movements. It's going to inspire a lot of people to get involved in different ways. And that's going to happen in different ways. For example, one way that has already started people to get more involved is that the right wing, especially the white Christian groups, are buying up guns, right? In record numbers again. But on the other hand, you know, it's like with folks of color and a lot of a large part of the white community too, who are liberal or progressive, it's inspired them too. There's just no question about it. But I have a feeling, and it's just my feeling, that in a way it may backfire on Obama and the powers that be, because it's the rising expectations thing again. Because I know in the 60s, that was the thing they said back then. It's like we had these rising expectations, and there was no way that we were going to be settling for certain things, you know. And I have a feeling that even because of Obama's in office and he carries himself with such dignity and all this other stuff, and seems to have some integrity, which I think is going quite fast, but a lot of black folks, I think, are going to become more active, you know. And even when they begin to see, they've already starting to see that a lot of his promises already are not happening, and he's backpedaling on things, that even if they come to the conclusion he's another politician, they're out there, and they're going to be disappointed, and I think they're going to be a bit angry. But I think they're going to also recognize that even hearing our voices, we have been saying all along, we need to continue organizing. We cannot rest. This is not that victory that they're claiming that Martin Luther King fought for, you know. Because this is
not the promised land.
It's not the promised land, right? We still got a long way to go, you know. But I think that it's going to be used in a lot of different ways. And even with the opportunists, they're going to come up and utilize it too. Probably a lot of more black folks and other folks are going to be running for all kind of offices, and from local to national or whatever. But I think that because of the economy too, with the crisis, it's always going to affect the masses of us first, as it always has. And it's going to pretty much tell us that we, from the bottom, have got to organize, continue organizing. All those mothers who already organized around public assistance, all those parents that are dealing, trying to make changes within the public education system, all those folks who are trying to even get the government to provide free health care, they're going to see that those things need to continue, you know. So it's going to be an interest. I think it's going to be an interesting year or the next 2 years, but I think this is what I'm looking at as the honeymoon. I think the honeymoon is not going to last long. Maybe a year, maybe two. But again, with this crisis, hey, I mean, who knows? And they're going to learn, too, that Obama's not really calling. He's not the one that really calls the shots. No president ever really has, you know, or at least in these modern times, you know. So he will be politician equals puppet, and people will begin to see connections, you know, and maybe begin to look at us like we're not really the crazy ones. That we've been saying this, you know, for the longest. And basically we've been just saying to people, get involved, you know, educate yourselves, organize, let's fight back, you know. And so we may be returned, I don't even want to say return, because I don't even think we need to return to the 60s. I mean, there was good things about it. I mean, it was such a great period, but I think we need to look for it going way beyond the 60s, you know, in terms of struggles that we begin to take back our lives, you know. So I think that in some ways, you know, the empire has been in bad shape. You know, nobody wanted to admit it, but they can't even, you know, front it no more. So, hey, this might be the time where our forces begin to get an audience and we get a chance to, like, raise some consciousness, you know, and possibly show some alternatives or get people to think of alternatives they already been working on that just needs to be nurtured. You know, but everybody's going to have a part to play, you know. And I just think also, like when we talk about workers are really going to need to embrace their potential power, you know. And all the different groups that have been oppressed for different reasons are going to have to look at how do they create community that actually allows them to take their power. You know, and then how do we bring it all together? You know, so it's like this may be that best of times again.
I think it's very interesting in that it's sort of under Bush the first and Bush the second, and even under Clinton to a certain extent, you had this massive expansion of the prison industrial complex, more cops, more guns, more repression, and always the underlying unspoken message is just basically resistance is futile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, abandon all hope.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way out of here. Nobody gets out of here alive in terms of what they're doing in the black community, certainly. And then all of a sudden you have this phenomena, this political phenomena, whatever. And that, you know, that famous poster
mm-hmm.
that says hope on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's what has come, you know, really you get the impression of this wave of affect, of emotion about hope.
Mm-hmm.
And to see how those two factors are dissonant, if you like, are in conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because the resistance is futile message hasn't gone away. Those mm-hmm. cops are still out there.
Mm-hmm.
The prisons are still standing their tentacles out and remaking all of the world, as you said, in their image.
Mm-hmm.
All of the institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that jars with this message of hope. So hopefully we can, rather than attacking Obama directly sort of before the election and saying, like, you know, he's for hope, we're against it, mm-hmm. which would be an awful thing to do. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly put yourself in that position.
Mm-hmm.
But that somehow that we try to turn it into a, you know, don't let the hope die, organize.
Right.
Kind of thing of right. keeping that momentum going and making it explicitly against the resistance is futile tendency.
Right. There's some folks that actually in the movement who want to actually utilize Obama's new slogans, you know, yes we can and hope and stuff, and say, well, listen, we, you know, he ain't the first person to say it. He don't own it.
Yeah.
You know, and to use that. But it's interesting that even when I was in Galway, Mick was showing me some articles he cut out on the Ternak 7 or the Ternak 9 in France.
Oh yes, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So right. the
Tikkun people who have been arrested on
right.
allegations,
yeah.
very sketchy allegations yeah. of potential criminal damage against the railway system, whatever, all very dubious.
Yeah, but and it was that, or it was some article you showed me on Iceland. It's like, here's these struggles going on in Iceland because they're going through an economic crisis. But one of them, I think it was Iceland then, but the thing about the Ternak, I forget it's 7 or 9, but it seemed like whatever the system is saying, they were definitely rooted in their community. Their community had big respect for them. They wasn't doing anything like the conspiratorial stuff that they've been claimed. Mm-hmm. But it was like really good that they were like doing just basic services in the community, just really being good neighbors, you know, real anarchists.
Yeah.
But the one in Iceland was actually utilizing Obama's "Yes, we can," because they were saying that the president or is the prime minister, one of them, should resign and some kind of new government be temporary government be instituted. But they were saying that to each other in encouragement, yes, we can. So it was like them taking Obama's statement and just bringing it to the progressive revolutionary activist side. You know, I think that it's part of the creativity that we need. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, there's a great power in that sort of idea of like unimaginable change is possible. You know, it's like that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, Che Guevara is, you know, do the impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's like we need to inspire each other. Mm-hmm. We need, and I say each other because we are part of these communities. We're not separate from these communities. Mm-hmm. You know, we're anarchists, but we're part of the communities. I think that's. Like, well, I think one of the things like about Malatesta, he makes that. He's great. But it's like, so we need to inspire each other with visions so that people can see, like, yeah, we can. I said that accidentally almost in Galway, and I had to catch myself. But I'm like, whoa, Obama didn't start that. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, it was the sisters. Yes, we can. Oh, God, they said this back in the 70s. It was a song, and I think he uses the song. But my point is that we need to be creative. They take stuff from us all the time.
Sure.
You know, every time we come up with something that's good, they will take it, commodify it, and then sell it right back. It's typical Che Guevara. You know, we need to be as creative, even if it's a guerrilla style, but it's talking about guerrilla cultural stuff. You know, we need to be able to get stuff and, like, throw it back that captures people's imaginations, that show people that we can do this. We are the power. We are the people. We are the changers, you know. So with this crisis, no matter how bad it is, and it is, if it's in Iceland, I never thought about Iceland. But if people in Iceland are feeling this and the young people and others are in the streets fighting, this is really worldwide. It is much bigger than folks imagine. I think I've been at fault for not really paying a lot of attention to it. Because I just took it as, oh man, here people again talking about the capitalism is in crisis and it's going to fall. And I hate to hear that stuff. It'll fall if we bring it down. It ain't just going to magically fall because of the internal contradictions, you know.
Well, they talk about systemic threat. There's only one systemic threat in this system, and that's us.
Yeah.
That's we it. Are the systemic threat, or else there isn't one.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have had a similar initial reaction to you. We're so used to the kind of ideological left, for lack of a better word, going on about capitalist crisis.
Yeah.
You just go, oh, yeah, yeah, we've heard this before. And I kind of, you know, this, it's actually my going around the US that actually made me think, oh, no, there is something going on. I arrived down in Miami. And there'd been a huge property boom down there, and lots of condos being built as part of that. And well, a whole lot of them, they just abandoned them. You know, like they built half the money and whatever. And I was going, wow, that's actually kind of weird. You know, like that's there's lots of these things. That's quite big. And I'm picking that up as I went around. But the other thing, I was going to plug this anyway. I listened to a podcast by Doug Henwood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of like broadcast out of New York.
Right.
Now, what I was going to mention it in, just after Obama's inauguration, he did this really clever thing where he took a segment of Martin Luther King's speech, I guess from towards the end, very radical, you know, talked about class politics, and he played that, and then he played segments of the Obama inauguration speech, and he kind of went, yeah, that's kind of rubbish. He didn't say anything of what he was saying. A lot of it's actually crap. It's, you know, it's not really what we're for at all. And he was obviously making the point that, you know, this whole attempt to claim even the King mantle is kind of, it's rubbish, you know.
Right.
Like if you actually look at what he's saying, if you get beyond the rhetoric about change and hope, and you look at the details, there's actually very little there whatsoever. But the other thing, actually, that I think he's very good at is that sort of quick overview economic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he did the same thing, like, remember 2 years ago, go, oh, it's not the final crisis of capitalism, you know, not interested in that sort of stuff at all. But definitely the idea that we're now in something that's much deeper than we have seen, than, you know, our parents probably have seen.
Right.
Certainly, you know, we have to go back to our grandparents' generation in a lot of cases to see something that's actually this big. It's a period of real change, you know, and in Ireland we're seeing it because we're so globalised, I think. So that kind of works going up, going down. It's like, whoa! You know, somebody just pulled the floor out and everybody's kind of falling.
Yeah, it's that Wile E. Coyote moment. Where the ears go down, the little sign comes up going,
Yeah, it's really big. And truly, I mean, I just did not stay up on it. But then too many people who I really respect in terms of their opinions were saying this. And I said, well, God. And then, you know, when I read the papers and it's like this economic crisis being felt all over the world. Mm-hmm. And people seem to be getting pissed at the United States, you know. So I'm like, well, maybe this is really going to be something big. But I also believe, you know, too, that the role that we play as the revolutionaries, you know, all the broad ranges of us, is going to be key, you know, how we can get out here to, like, you know, like, challenge people, educate people, get people to think that there's alternatives to this stuff, you know, and that it's not really rocket scientist stuff, that we can do this. I think it's so key, the part that we play. Because I talked about, like, the Hurricane Katrina situation before, like, with the Black movement. There was such a great opportunity to pull together a Black movement after 30 years of defeat and inaction. And the groups that was getting together around Katrina got to fighting each other over the most pettiest stuff, which a lot of times revolved around egos of who was going to be the leader and who was going to control monies, you know. And things fell apart. And so it's like, I think Malatesta, he would give an example of, there was a situation one time where it seemed like the revolutionary forces in Italy were on the verge of winning, but the people didn't quite know whether it was going to happen, and they had to make a decision, do they move forward or do they retreat and rethink it? And they just couldn't figure out what to do. And it's like, but this is the revolutionary forces. It's like, is this the same situation that we're in? We got to figure out what to do. You know, are we going to blow it? Are we going to fight each other? You know? And I think that the thing that concerns me the most about this is like, this is a great opportunity. I hope that we don't blow it. You know? Great opportunity. You know? And I don't know who else besides us comes with... the agenda is self-organization. The agenda is not, you got to join my organization, you got to believe in this ideology. You know, we're like, you know, our thing has historically been faith in being human and being in community with each other. Like, come on, man. I mean, like, every other group is going to be trying to just use people. You know, so that's why I just think that this is our time. We have got to use it.
Seems like a good note to end on. If you're listening to this before the 7th of March and you're in Dublin or in Ireland, Shanti will be speaking at the Anarchist Book Fair in Liberty Hall. So you can come along and hear some more and meet some of the rest of us here as well. If you're listening to it after that date, I guess I'll send you to a webpage. I'm going to send you to www.anarchismo.net, which is a page I'm involved in running, and we report on international struggles and anarchist involvement in them from all over the world. So thanks for listening.